Today is Wednesday, June 28th. We're going to work on wrapping up respiratory information, and we'll begin digestive information today. Okay, so why don't we start on page 76? We left off, need to look at number 6 there on page 76. Okay, so this entire page is a practice page for understanding how respiration rate changes influence blood pH and vice versa. So looking at number 6 there, we've got a pulmonary embolism that can cause a low oxygen count in the bloodstream. So if you're thinking about a pulmonary embolism, let's just define what that means off the bat. What is embolism?
Clot.
Clot, yeah. So it's a blood clot, you're right, it moved to that pulmonary location and it blocked the blood flow. So if you've got hypoxemia, which is low oxygen in the blood, what does the respiratory center do in response to hypoxemia? Increase, good. So make the respiration rate increase. Okay, so letter A, respiration rate will increase. Respiratory center will, of course, set up a faster respiration rate. And so this is not just straight out memorization. How does breathing faster fix your problem? Good. Hyperventilate brings in more oxygen, and of course more oxygen is going to solve our problem since we're low oxygen in the first place. Okay, so hyperventilate will help to bring in more oxygen. Okay, number 7 talks about cigarette smoke and carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide does impair the ability of hemoglobin to transport oxygen. So thinking about that, what is our stimulus? Low oxygen. Okay, letter A there, stimulus is low oxygen. This sounds familiar, right? How does the respiratory center respond? Increase respiration, good. So just kind of a big picture question here. What impact do you think cigarette smoke will have on brain cells? Low oxygen. I heard one of you say it. Yeah, it'll decrease the oxygen going to your brain. So they say that if you study while smoking, you won't remember as much. So that seems like a no-brainer, right? Yeah. But it's interesting, you know, if you're in a smoky environment studying, if you're smoking while you study, then of course there's impaired oxygen supply and we have harder times making those connections when there's low oxygen in the brain. Okay, number 8, patients who are administered an oxygen cannula in the nose may experience a decreased respiration rate. This is kind of a big picture thinking question, so what are we looking at here? If you're delivering oxygen, you're getting perhaps a good amount of oxygen in your bloodstream. In fact, you may get, maybe getting too much oxygen in your bloodstream. All right, now, does that kind of help you point in the right direction? Okay, so what's going to be the problem with getting too much oxygen? Let's leave CO2 and hydrogen alone because they're actually not going to be an issue here. The entire issue is excess oxygen. So how does your respiration rate respond when you've got too much oxygen?
It decreases.
It decreases, yeah. So that's kind of something we don't think about. It's like a no-brainer, right? Give somebody oxygen if they need the oxygen. But if they're getting too much oxygen, it can actually lower their respiration rate. Do you know why? The faster you breathe, the more oxygen you get. The slower you breathe, the less oxygen you get. Yeah, so it's all about reducing the amount of oxygen into the bloodstream. So for the answer for number 8 there, decreased respiration will slow the amount of oxygen. slow the amount of oxygen entering the bloodstream. Slow the amount of oxygen entering the bloodstream. There's actually some info out there for respiratory care therapists to not just wholesale administer oxygen, whether or not a patient needs it, because of this very reason. You know, if a patient doesn't need oxygen, then maybe they don't need the respiration rate slowed. Excess oxygen, hyperoxia, can actually cause the respiration rate to slow. Kind of a interesting thought there. Let's see, any questions so far on numbers 6, 7, or 8? All right, so number 9, do you notice any keywords in there that gives you an idea for what the stimulus may be?
Acidosis.
Yeah, acidosis. Okay, and so during acidosis, what happens to the respiration rate?
Increases.
And why is that?
Get the CO2 out.
He may not have an oxygen problem. His oxygen may be fine. The big issue here is get rid of that CO2. So his respiration rate will increase. You go to check on him, sitting in a chair. What is he doing? Hyperventilating. Yep, he's panting. He's hyperventilating. Okay, so number 9, hyperventilation tells us a person may be experiencing acidosis. And finally, number 10, if your respiratory system can't regulate respiration to accommodate for blood chemistry changes, what is another system that can help us out? Urinary. Yep. Urinary system. So number 10, your urinary system also plays a role in acid-base balance. So that's kind of the heavyweight topic for this chapter. Do you have any questions so far on hypoventilation, and control of respiration? Okay. Page 77 is going to take us in a little different direction. Keep in mind that we're talking about 4 events of respiration. We just got through talking about pulmonary ventilation and control of the respiratory rate. And now we're going to talk about how we do gas exchanges. So in order to appreciate gas exchange, we need to look at air as a bigger picture. The air that we breathe is not just oxygen, it's actually other gases mixed in. So what else is in the air that you breathe besides oxygen? Nitrogen. A little bit of carbon dioxide, a little bit of water vapor, yeah. And the big one is, in fact, nitrogen. Nitrogen's about, say, 70-something percent, almost 80% of the air that you breathe. So we're going to leave nitrogen alone. The only issue for nitrogen is those who deep-sea dive and airplane ride afterwards. But we're going to focus instead on oxygen and CO2. So when we think about the air that we breathe, each gas is part of a mixture. And I want you to think about a bag of M&Ms right now. You know, if you have your favorite color of M&M, even though they taste the same, right? Okay, if you have your favorite color, they're part of a mixture. So if you really like the green M&Ms, once you pick all those out, you still have a remaining bag of M&Ms. That's how air and gases work. Oxygen is just part of a whole, and if you were to remove the oxygen from the air that you breathe, you still have a good amount of nitrogen gas, carbon dioxide, water vapor, and some other smaller minute traces. So when we think about gases as a whole, they're forming a mixture, and each gas exerts its own pressure as part of a mixture. Well, looking at oxygen, it's about 21% of the air that we breathe. Does it exert a whole lot of pressure compared to what nitrogen can exert? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the big one here that exerts a lot of pressure is nitrogen gas. You know, oxygen does exert some pressure, but it's nowhere near the pressure that can be exerted by nitrogen, since it makes up so much more of the air that we breathe. What we're talking about is called Dalton's Law, and it states that each gas in a mixture exerts its own pressure. That pressure exerted by the gas is known as a partial pressure. These pressures, by the way, are what drives gas movements into and out of your body. So if you're thinking about diffusion, and I've got a bottle of gas here, we know that these molecules move from areas of higher concentration, or in this case, higher pressure, to what?
Lower.
Yep, so high pressure to low pressure. So on this chart, I would not memorize the percentages for anything, and I wouldn't memorize any of the numbers except those here in red. Let's pick on oxygen for just a moment. Outside your body, the oxygen pressure is around 159 millimeters mercury at sea level. We're close to sea level, so we'll go with that number. Don't memorize 159, but look at the trend. We travel from high pressure outside your body. We drop a little bit as the air enters your body and encounters water vapor. As you travel into the bloodstream, we're going to find a normal partial pressure for oxygen to be between 80 and 100 millimeters mercury of pressure. So 80 to 100 is a good number for oxygen's partial pressure. Notice that the warning number there is 60. What happens at a partial pressure of 60 for oxygen? Low oxygen, hypoxia. And at that point, what happens to your respiration rate? Yeah, it increases. So if you're, say, at 75 millimeters mercury of pressure, has your respiration rate increased yet? Not yet. Even though you're not inside that nice normal range of 80 to 100, 75 is not yet considered hypoxia. Not even 70, not even 65. But at 60, now you've hit the bottom limit and your respiration rate will increase. So we'll talk about why there's a little fudge room there in terms of those numbers. It has to do with the amount of oxygen that you're already transporting on your blood cells. By the time we reach your cells, we're using that oxygen to make what? ATP. Yep. So we've got a bottomed out number here around 40 in our cells, and that's because we're constantly using it by mitochondria to make ATP. Watch the trend. 159, 104, about 80 to 100, down to 40. We're going in what direction? High to low. Yep. So the trend is to move oxygen a longer pressure gradient from high concentration outside your body to low concentration or pressure in your cells. So that is how oxygen travels. It's along a pressure gradient into your body. Let's talk about carbon dioxide. Again, the only numbers to know here are the normal between 35 and 45 millimeters. And watch the gradient. This time, cells are making carbon dioxide. In fact, a byproduct of making ATP is CO2. Notice in your bloodstream, we're looking at a normal level between 35 and 45 millimeters mercury. That's in an artery, by the way. And then we continue to decrease until we get outside your body, where we've got only 0.3 millimeters mercury of CO2. So don't memorize the trend. Just appreciate that we move from high concentration or pressure to low pressure outside the body. That's how carbon dioxide exits. It's along a pressure gradient. So let's talk about these numbers down here, 35 and 45. Let's go back to our equation from Monday's class period. Okay. Carbon dioxide, of course, is transported in blood plasma, and it dissolves to make something called carbonic acid, which breaks down to give us hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions. If you have lots of CO2 in your bloodstream, what impact does that have on hydrogen ions?
Increases
it, right. Now, what does that do to your blood pH?
Drops it,
right. So we'll go back to our 7.35 to 7.45 range. This is heading into acidosis territory. And we've got increased CO2, and we've got increased hydrogen ions as we head into acidosis territory. So this is kind of weird to think about, but notice if you exceed 45 millimeters mercury, you actually drop your pH. So that is greater than 45. By the way, I should point out that when we talk about partial pressures, they'll place a P in front of the gas. It's a big P, it's a little P, it's Sesame Street, no matter how you look at it. So big P, little P, either way, you're looking at a partial pressure for this gas here, CO2. Let's talk about alkalosis. Alkalosis is the opposite direction, so you'll notice it means that we're less than 35 millimeters mercury for CO2 levels. So as we head in this direction, and alkalosis, we're looking at decreased CO2. What impact does that have on hydrogen ions? Decrease them also. And we're looking at less than 35. Okay, so this is kind of going back to that whole game of hyper and hypoventilation, right? Okay, so the more CO2 you've got, the more acidic you become in terms of your blood plasma. And of course, the less CO2 you've got, the more alkaline your blood plasma becomes. The less you can memorize this stuff, the better you'll be, because it's real easy to flip-flop stuff here. So if you can think this through, work out an equation like this, that'll help you keep this straight, rather than just straight up memorizing what's happening here. Do you have questions so far on this chart? Okay, so numbers to know are the red numbers there. 80 to 100 is a normal partial pressure for oxygen in arterial blood gas samples. 35 to 45 is normal for a CO2 sample in an arterial blood gas pool. Okay. So the whole point of sharing that with you was to talk about gas exchange, and I'd like to start with the gas exchange that occurs in your lungs. We call this gas exchange external respiration. Why external? It's what's coming from the outside, right? So the outside world first contacts you at the alveoli between the pulmonary capillaries and those very thin-walled air sacs. So let's kind of get perspective for where we're at. There is your air sac at the very top up here, and here's a pulmonary capillary traveling around that air sac. We are breathing in oxygen. Oxygen travels along a pressure gradient from high pressure to low pressure. You'll notice that oxygen then moves into the bloodstream. What is the number one most common mechanism for oxygen to be transported? Hemoglobin, good. So once in the bloodstream, oxygen diffuses into a red blood cell. There it binds to a hemoglobin molecule for transport. That is the number one mechanism for transporting oxygen. You'll also notice that number two, we can dissolve oxygen in blood plasma, but that is not a very common method. It's something like 2% of the oxygen is transported that way. So I'd like to show you hemoglobin one more time. We've talked about hemoglobin way back in the blood chapter. What do you know about the structure of a hemoglobin molecule? Right, it's quaternary level protein. It's got four polypeptide chains. Each polypeptide chain has its own group called a heme group. And what does each heme group contain? Iron, right. And out of all these parts on your hemoglobin molecule, what specific part binds the oxygen? The iron, right. The iron binds the oxygen. So when iron and oxygen come together, this molecule forms oxyhemoglobin, which has what color? Bright red, good. So bright red oxyhemoglobin means we're transporting adequate oxygen. If, however, you lose oxygen, what color does this molecule become? Darker red, exactly. Good. So those colors are kind of a telltale sign for what we're doing in the bloodstream. We talked about this before. The molecule of hemoglobin changes shape to make it easier for other oxygens to ride. Do you remember how many oxygens are the max number that can be transported?
Four.
Yeah, back to that magic number of four. So when we're transporting four oxygens on a hemoglobin, we say we have a fully saturated hemoglobin molecule. Anything less is a partially saturated hemoglobin molecule. So we know the percentages. 100% saturation means four oxygens are bound to the hemoglobin. If you have three, that means you've got a 75% saturation rate. Two, of course, is 50. One is 25%. So if you flip the page with me, going over to page 78, we're going to explore something called an oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve. And if you look at the second bullet point, underneath it there's something that reads 75% of the oxygen that's transported is a reserve supply. Okay, so under normal conditions, we only dump off 25% of our oxygen to cells and tissues. We actually transport 75% for a reserve supply. So when you look at a partial pressure like 80 to 100, you're actually looking at nearly four oxygens bound to every hemoglobin. So you're looking at almost a fully saturated hemoglobin molecule. That's why you can slip below 80% or 80 millimeters mercury and head down towards 60 and not run into emergency territory right off the bat. That's because 75% of the oxygen you transport is on reserve. That means you're transporting about how many oxygens?
Three.
At least three. Yep, so at least three are on reserve. So what is the advantage of carrying at least three at all times? Here comes lions, tigers, and bears. Oh my, you gotta run. There's no choice. And when you start running, what happens to your oxygen levels? You're using it to make
ATP,
and the demand becomes great, and there's your demand because you can get it, of course, from those oxygens being held on reserve. So it kind of gives you a little kickstart until you can start breathing adequately to get enough oxygen into your system. Think of it as a backup emergency supply. Okay, so why don't we talk about this oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve? You've got one in your course pack on the bottom of page 78. I give you a different one on the top of 79. First of all, let me introduce this curve to you. We have an x-axis along the bottom, and that x-axis is measuring partial pressure of oxygen. There's a tiny a there that indicates we're looking at partial pressure in an artery. We are measuring this partial pressure in millimeters mercury, and our scale runs from 0 to 100. Okay. On the y-axis, we are measuring hemoglobin percent saturation. We're traveling from 0% up to 100%. And just to make the point here that we can transport 1 through 4 oxygens on our hemoglobin. So at 1, you know, we're looking at 25% saturation. Carry 2 oxygens, 50% saturation. 3 is 75, and of course 4 is ideal because that means you're fully saturated. And that's 100% saturation. Okay, so we've got our axes taken care of. Let's explore why this is an S-shaped curve. You'll notice this does not travel just directly up in a straight line. We have an upward peak, and then we slope off once we get above 75%. Why 75% does it tend to slope off? How many are you transporting at 75%? How many oxygens?
Three.
Good, right? Okay, because there's your reserve supply. it'd be even better to transport a total of four. And so as we get closer to 100%, you'll see that we do tend to level off there. The reason for this gentle S-shaped curve is due to affinity. What gas does hemoglobin have an affinity for? Oxygen, yeah. So oxygen and hemoglobin like each other. They have an affinity for each other. And that's why you see a steep line going up. That's to encourage oxygen to ride on the hemoglobin. Once we hit around 75%, you're going to notice we have a gentle slope off because, you know, we've kind of achieved our saturation rate that we need to be able to stay alive without hyperventilating. So you can say we're kind of in homeostatic range once we reach 75%. Okay, are you so far so good with what we're looking at? Let's talk more closely about the lines. Most of these curves will have three lines. The one in the very center is always considered your normal line. What they're looking at is normal body temperature, normal oxygen, normal CO2, pH, those kinds of things. A lot of these curves will also include a different kind of chemical. The one on the top of the page, that's 79, shows DPG. We're not going to worry about that chemical. Okay, so if you see something like DPG or some other chemical, don't worry about that one. That's not part of our conversation. You'll notice there are two dotted lines here. One is shifted to the right, and another one shifted to the left. We're going to use that language. We're going to talk about the normal line in the middle for CO2, temperature, pH, hydrogen ion concentration. And we're going to talk about the line that shifts you to the right and the line that shifts you to the left. Okay? So to make it a little easier to read, I'm going to actually shift you to this picture on the top of page 79. And the reason I'm going to use this one, it's got lines drawn in for me, so I don't have to do a lot of guesswork here. Okay, so let's take 60 down here on our partial pressure. Does that set off any warning signals if you're at 60? What's your normal PO2? 80 to 100, and what does 60 indicate? Hypoxia. Okay, so we've already got an issue here being down there at 60 partial pressure. Okay, so we'll just keep that in the back of our minds, and we're going to say that body temp is normal, CO2 is normal, everything looks good. So which of these three lines should I go to? Blue in the middle. Why is that? Everything is normal, so I go to the normal line in the middle. Okay, so if I'm looking for the percent saturation, if my PO2 is 60, you'll notice that we're going to go over here to somewhere in the mid-80s. So percent saturation tells me I'm transporting about how many oxygens? How come three? 80%, right. 75% is technically 3, right? So if I'm in the mid-80s, I probably have at least 3 on most of my hemoglobins. Okay, let's do another one. Let's say this is close to 50. Let's say that's about 51 for our partial pressure. Let's say everything is normal. Now what is your percent saturation? 82, 83%. Okay, I'm still transporting 3 oxygens on my hemoglobin. Goodness, go down to around 40. Looks like about 42 there for our partial pressure. Everything's normal, so stop at which line? Stop at the middle one. Come across. What's our percent saturation? 70, 73%. So now what do you know about the number of oxygens we transport? It's decreased, yeah. And am I transporting at least 3? Probably not. Yeah, I'm probably transporting 2, maybe 3 on some of them. So as we continue to lower our partial pressure, what happens to our percent saturation? It goes down, it decreases, right. So as we continue to decrease our percent saturation and as we tend to see a drop in our PO2, what happens to your respiration rate? Increase, yeah, because we're getting into that danger territory. So let's go back to 60 one more time. We know what the normal number is going to be in terms of percent saturation. We're looking at mid-80s there. Let's now say that we are exercising and our body temperature is increasing, so we're becoming hot, okay? Now we're no longer normal in terms of body temp. This time I'm going to shift you from the normal line to this right line. All right, so I'm coming from 60. I travel up the dotted line. I stop at the line shifted to the right. And what is our percent saturation?
82.
About 82%. For the sake of comparison, when we were 60 partial pressure and normal body temp, we were higher than that, right? Somewhere in the mid-80s. So what did exercise do to your percent saturation of hemoglobin? Decreased. So what's happening to all that oxygen? Making ATP, exactly. It's diffusing out into cells and tissues. It's making ATP. And when you exercise, what happens to your respiration rate?
Increases,
right. So we're losing saturation. That will impact, of course, our oxygen levels reaching the brain and will eventually start to hyperventilate. Okay, let me give you one to try. Let's say that our... Not yet? We'll do one together? Okay. Let's see. Let's do our PO2 is 60. Okay. And this time I'm cold and we're going to shift you to this left line. See if you can estimate a percent saturation for me. 90, is that what you're getting? Okay, so what happens to your percent saturation when you're cold compared to when you're hot? It increases when you're cold. Your percent saturation of oxygen decreases when you're hot. Why the difference? You got it, yeah. The more, if you're cold, of course, your oxygen stays bound to your hemoglobin. If you're warm, the oxygens diffuse out into your cells and tissues to make ATP. So it's all about this body temperature regulation thing. So hot temperatures make oxygen diffuse out to generate ATP. Cold temperatures, cold body temperature, is going to make the oxygen stay bound to hemoglobin. Take this big picture for just a moment. What color does our skin turn when we're hot? Okay, and so why is that? More blood to the surface, and that blood is oxygenated, and it is bright red because of that. Good. Now, if you're cold, what color do you turn? Why is that? Decreased oxygen, and the oxygen stays bound to what?
Hemoglobin,
right. So instead of losing oxygen to your cells and tissues, oxygen stays bound to hemoglobin, and it travels close to your vital organs to keep you alive. So all of this curve here actually is the basis for understanding the color changes when we're hot or cold. Okay, let's do another one. Let's talk about, say, blood pH. Let's say we've got a person in acidosis. Okay, is that a decreased pH or an increased pH?
Decreased
pH. Okay, so which way should we shift the line? To the right. Okay, so compare acidosis percent saturation to alkalosis percent saturation. Which one is going to give you a higher percent saturation? Shift you to the left, yeah. So alkalosis shifts you left. I know that's up, right? That's what screws people up, because you're actually going up, not left, but it is the left-hand line. But nonetheless, this green line is technically a shift to the left, and that increases your percent saturation compared to the same PO2 and a shift to the right. Almost a 10% change there. Okay. Let me give you a moment to look at page 79 with me. And there's a couple of practice problems. I'm going to cut you guys loose for just a few minutes. Why don't we try, say, practice problems 1 through 5 on that page, see how we do. All right, so for number one, we're looking at a PO2 of 51 millimeters mercury. The catch is the body temperature is normal. So we have to go ahead and decide which of our three lines should we go to? the middle one, good. So they've already labeled this one for us. We're just going to travel up to that blue line, come across, and you estimate. What did y'all get?
82,
that sounds good. 82, 83, somewhere in that neighborhood is good for a percent saturation. Let's see, number two talks about a PO2 of 51 millimeters mercury and body temperature increases. So again, we have to decide, which line do you use?
Shift
right, yeah. So again, start with your 51, and you stop at the red line, and you come across and read. What did y'all get?
75.
About 75, 73, somewhere in that neighborhood, okay? So you can see that as your body temperature increased, you actually lost saturation. All that oxygen is traveling into cells and tissues to make ATP. For number three, we're looking at a PO2 of 51 and a person who experiences alkalosis. So now which line do we use?
Shift
left, yeah. So I go all the way to the green line and I come across. What number did y'all get? Somewhere in the upper 80s, maybe close to 90, okay? So as we look in alkalosis direction, we actually see a shift toward the left and an increase in saturation. Just a side question there. Normally, how does alkalosis affect your respiration rate?
It decreases it,
yeah, causing hypoventilation. How'd you do with numbers 1 through 3? Okay, so far? Let's see, number four, the percent saturation if PO2 is 42 and body temperature is normal. All right, so let's hit that bottom line, come up to which of our three? The middle one, good. And when you came across, about what percent did you get? About 72%? Okay, that sounds pretty good. All right, and then what happens to your percent saturation if we're still at 42, but your body temperature cools down? It increases, right. Which direction would you in fact shift? To the left, yeah. Decrease temperature, shift you to the left. Number five, we're looking at acidosis. That's my clue there. Which direction do we shift this thing? Shift it to the right. So I'm going to use our red dotted line. Our PO2, well, I don't give you one there, do I? So we're just going to shift it to the right. And what happens to your percent saturation anytime you shift right? Decreases saturation, right. So anytime you shift right, you decrease saturation. What happens anytime you shift left? Increase saturation, right. Just tell you about something really cool about this topic here. They have discovered, actually some 30, 40 years ago, that if they want to save somebody's life who's had heart trauma, maybe from a heart attack, that one way to help their heart is to cool the body down, something like the low 80s. So what do we do to percent saturation when we cool your body temperature? Increase it, good. And your heart surgery, yeah, they sure do. So what happens to respiration rate when your percent saturation increases? Your respiration decreases, right. So they found that that's one way to help take the load off the heart. You're not having to work as hard if the body temperature is cooler. This is also the reason behind why, you know, sometimes in the wintertime, we don't have frozen ponds around here, but up north, if someone falls through a frozen pond and is submerged for some 45 minutes, or in an avalanche they're submerged, if they shift that graph to the left, their body may in fact still be alive after 45 minutes or even longer in a cold environment. So what happens to all the oxygen? Goes to your vital organs, right? It stays bound to hemoglobin, it shifts left, and so we actually don't let all the oxygen out to make ATP. We save the oxygen for transport on that hemoglobin. So kind of a cool concept here that we're working with. I'm going to leave numbers 6 through 10 for you all to work on. And then we can actually hit those if you need to hear the answers come Monday after the break. Okay. Just a little bit left and we're done with this chapter. That's page 80. Okay, carbon monoxide is certainly not a gas that we want to be transporting, but it is one that is bound irreversibly with hemoglobin if present in your bloodstream. So carbon monoxide is CO, not CO2. It is a waste product of combustion. So fireplaces, kerosene heaters, car engines, even cigarettes produce carbon monoxide. And if present, it travels along a pressure gradient into your body and binds to the same seat that oxygen wants to bind. So unfortunately, because it is an irreversible binding to hemoglobin, it prevents oxygen from binding and getting a ride. So if it's a mild case of carbon monoxide poisoning, people may have a throbbing headache. In a worst case scenario, they may need a hyperbaric chamber to help force the oxygen on and the CO off. Some people die from carbon monoxide poisoning simply because it is an odorless, colorless gas. There's no way to know that it's present in the air that you're breathing except for the awful headache that may ensue. Mm-hmm. So this is the reason that we avoid sitting in closed garages with a car running. The gas, of course, is going to be combusted and burned, and carbon monoxide is what's being pumped out the exhaust pipe. So pretty deadly gas for the way that it bumps off oxygen for transport. So we've talked about external respiration. We need to now focus on how to get rid of that CO2, which is our last topic. So CO2 is loaded into our bloodstream during internal respiration. Where is this taking place? Inside your systemic capillaries, cells, and tissues, right? And we're following a pressure gradient, so carbon dioxide travels from your cells and tissues where it's produced into your bloodstream. What is the number one transport method for CO2? Bicarbonate. Yeah, back to our old equation here. When carbon dioxide dissolves in your blood plasma and the water inside our blood cells, it is most commonly transported as HCO3. That is bicarbonate ion. Okay, so bicarbonate is the number one transport mechanism. By the way, carbon dioxide is the number one stimulus for respiration, not oxygen. That may come as a surprise, right? Why is oxygen not normally your number one stimulus? How much do you carry on reserve? Yeah, you got about 75% right on reserve. So 75% is in reserve. This carbon dioxide, though, is the one that directly influences your blood pH. Let me make a point that oxygen does not influence your blood pH directly. It's the carbon dioxide that has the direct play on your blood pH. Other ways to transport carbon dioxide, some in your blood plasma, some can bind to hemoglobin, but I should mention it's not going to compete with oxygen for a seat on the iron molecule. It's actually going to bind to the amino acids, forming something called carbaminohemoglobin. That kind of rhymes, carbaminohemoglobin. Okay, so there is no competition for the oxygen. Carbon dioxide rides on the amino acids, forming carbaminohemoglobin. I like that. We'll do that again. That's a good one, yeah. It's like you just want to say it over and over because it sounds so cool. Okay, so take-home message out of this chapter is CO2 is your number one stimulus for respiration. Oxygen only becomes a stimulus when we hit what number? 60. Yeah, 60 is your magic number for oxygen. So, yeah, CO2 is your number one stimulus for respiration. Hey, we're done with this chapter. That is it. Page 80 wraps it up. So why don't we do a break, clean out our brain, and then we'll be back at page 83 in about, say, 10 minutes. Okay, so about 2:05, let's meet back here. Okay, so digestive system is going to be an overview of anatomy and phys. We're going to talk about accessory organs in this chapter. And probably one of the easier ways to keep this stuff straight is to look at what each organ contributes to the process of digestion and absorption. So if you think of them in terms of individual pieces that work together for a greater good, that is one way to organize mentally what the mouth, the esophagus, stomach, and so forth contribute. Just want to lay some groundwork here with definitions. I mean, I know you guys probably have heard about the word digestion since you were in elementary school, but digestion is technically divided into a mechanical process, which is the physical tearing apart of food particles. Chewing your food is a mechanical type of digestion. So is peristalsis and segmentation, which grinds food into smaller pieces. Okay, so technically, when you're talking about the chemical breakdown, we're talking about hydrolysis. So way back in Bio 210, you probably talked about anabolic and catabolic reactions. Catabolic reactions are the ones that break apart particles, big polymers, into their building blocks. That is what true digestion really is. It's about taking polymers of a food, breaking it into its building blocks or monomers. Okay? So the word hydrolysis is going to come up quite a bit in this chapter. How would you describe absorption? Bring it in, yeah. Whatever you want to keep has to get into your bloodstream. So moving these particles into the bloodstream is the mechanism of absorption. We're going to talk first through the major organs of the alimentary canal. It is sometimes called the GI tract, gastrointestinal tract, digestive system. So there's a lot of names for this one system. The accessory organs, such as the pancreas, salivary glands, gallbladder, liver, teeth, tongue, are going to contribute to the process of what the main primary alimentary canal organs are doing. So in this picture, we actually see the mouth to the anus as the main pathway. From the mouth, we travel through the pharynx, down the esophagus. Once we enter the stomach, we're in a region known as the cardia region. The piece that expands out is known as
the fundus.
Good. The main portion here?
The body.
Good. And the terminal portion?
Pylorus.
Good. What is the next organ we travel into?
Duodenum.
Good. Small intestine has three regions, duodenum, jejunum, and good. And then you pass into a large intestine with a cecum, and then colons, ascending, going across,
transverse,
good, and finally the rectum and anus. Yeah. So that is the primary tract that we're going to follow. That's the main digestive organs. The accessories are things like liver, gallbladder, pancreas. In the mouth, we've got teeth, tongue, and salivary glands. So they contribute to digestion, but they're not actively involved in the movement of food along like those other organs do. What we see in our GI tract are four primary organs, or layers rather, that make up the organ. Let me start you with the deepest tissue layer, known as mucosa. Like the name implies, it's made up of what membrane?
Mucus,
good. So mucous membrane is one that secretes and lubricates with mucus. Mucus is also great for trapping bacteria, viruses, and debris inside our digestive tract. So it is the layer against which food will glide and slide past. So the mucous membrane in this picture is the one that opens into a lumen. Have you heard the word lumen before? Okay, so opening here is the lumen. That's where food's going to travel through the white space in this picture. Let's see, our next layer down is called submucosa. What are some things we find in the submucosal layer? Blood vessels, some nerves, glands, yeah, things like mucus glands, good. Okay, then we come upon another layer called muscularis externa. There's typically two layers of muscle here, an inner circular layer and an outer longitudinal layer. These muscles are involved in a rhythmic contraction known as peristalsis. Peristalsis's goal is to move your food along to the next organ. The stomach does have an additional oblique layer of muscularis externa, but it's the exception rather than the rule. Finally, the outermost layer is known as your mesentery or peritoneum. The peritoneum is actually a membrane known as our serous membrane. And so for that reason, we sometimes call this the serosa layer. So how many words have we used, right? Serosa and mesentery and peritoneum pretty much reference the same layers. Okay, so let me explain what mesentery specifically means. Mesentery specifically means the visceral peritoneum. Is that the innermost peritoneum or the outer layer? That's the innermost, good. So mesentery is technically the visceral peritoneum. It covers the outside surface of all your digestive organs, with the exception of the entirety of the liver. Your kidneys are not entirely covered either. But if you're female, the peritoneum also covers the uterus. So pretty expansive set of membrane in that abdominopelvic cavity. So they recently came out this spring, in fact, and said the mesentery is an organ. And, you know, we've kind of thought, well, yeah, duh, it's an organ. It's made up of at least two tissue types. There are blood vessels embedded in the mesentery. But I guess in terms of medical, they're going to start treating it as if it were an organ, just like they consider your stomach to be an organ. So kind of a cool concept that we've called it an organ in terms of A&P because of the way it's built. But medically, they're going to start looking at that mesentery as contributing as much as a typical organ would contribute to your body. So here you can see the large intestine around the outside, and inside you see a clear colorless layer embedded with blood vessels. That is the mesentery. Okay, bottom of your page has some terms that we're going to discuss. These may be some that you're already familiar with. If not, we'll definitely hit these as we go through all these different organs. All right, how about questions on page 83? So we're going to take a tour, starting with the mouth. We're going to notice first the anatomy of the organ, and then we'll talk about what it does in terms of physiology. So in terms of structure for the mouth, this is the site of ingestion, meaning what? Taking in the food, right? So, you know, if you want to talk about going to get something to eat, ingestion is the process of eating that food. So let's talk about the structure that's involved. We have lips that form the anterior surface, teeth behind those lips. We have cheeks that make up the lateral walls. What makes up the superior surface of your mouth? Hard palate, good. The floor of your mouth has a tongue with a frenulum. And of course, at the back of the mouth, we're now going to encounter the pharynx and a set of tonsils. Okay, so in terms of how we lubricate and moisten our food, we talk about salivary glands. Technically, they are accessory organs. So we'll include them now since they're pertinent to our discussion of moistening food, allowing us to taste that food, and mixing that food so we can swallow it. So where are the primary sets of salivary glands? Cheek, you got set parotid here over the masseter muscle. Up underneath, you've got submandibulars, and under the tongue, sublinguals, good. And interestingly, there's actually hundreds of salivary glands inside your mouth. It's just these three primary sets that we point out. So, you know, you're constantly secreting saliva into your mouth as much as a liter or so per day. More so, of course, when you're eating and you know, of course, that increases the salivation process. So what is found in saliva? Watery, right? What else? An enzyme, good. What else? Electrolytes. Mucus, yeah. So if your mouth is dry, your saliva tastes really thick like mucus. I know we don't often think, we don't talk about this topic. It's not what you share with your friends at the dinner table, right? Boy, my mucus feels really, you know, my saliva feels like mucus today. Not what we normally discuss. But when your mouth is dry, it is rubbery, and we naturally feel an urge to drink when our mouth is dry. So there is a combination of both mucus and serous fluids in your saliva. When you dry, you feel the urge to drink to help moisten up that saliva. The water when you drink actually converts that mucus to a more thin and less rubbery tasting saliva. So it makes you just want to swallow when you talk about it, right? Okay. Notice there is an enzyme in there. It is called salivary amylase. How do you know it's an enzyme?
ACE.
Yeah, ACE, A-S-E, good. What does it help to break down? Good. What's the building block of a starch?
Sugar.
Good. So amylase helps you to hydrolyze, there's that word, starch into sugars. Just wanted to mention some things that would induce you to salivate. Certainly talking about food that's tasty would help you to salivate, smelling that food, tasting that food. And of course, being nauseated can make you salivate as well. What impact does the sympathetic nervous system have on salivation? Yeah, parasympathetic makes you rest and digest. Sympathetic shuts you down. So when you're under sympathetic control, you may in fact have a dry mouth. Any of you all going into dental hygiene? Just one? Okay, I'll do the, we'll go through the teeth then. This is your program in 5 minutes. So. Okay, babies are born, of course, with typically no teeth. By around age 6 months, they are going to start to see teeth emerge. And those teeth will emerge up until around ages of 5 years. So there's about 20 teeth that are going to emerge in a baby that are called milk teeth or deciduous teeth. The goal of those teeth is to at least give you something to chew with, but eventually they fall out. Thus the name deciduous, or like leaves that fall off in the wintertime. Starting around age 5 or 6, we start getting our permanent teeth, and we may have as many as how many of those? 32 permanent teeth. Let's see, our teeth are actually built based on what we chew and eat. The front teeth are shaped like chisels. They're called the incisors. Those are the front four teeth, top and bottom. Okay. We also have cuspids, which are called canines. They're the sharp, pointy teeth that we often refer to as eye teeth. They're great for tearing and biting. We then have some premolars, and then finally we have some molars. These teeth that start here and work all the way back, they're more built for biting, tearing, and the back ones are big, flat grinding stones. So things that require a longer chew, such as, say, maybe meat products, sometimes leafy greens take a longer time to chew, you're going to grind those back there between those flat molars. So our teeth are actually built for tearing proteins, and they're also built for grinding proteins and plant matter. A typical tooth has a very hardened enamel on the outside. Once your tooth erupts and is formed, that's all the enamel will ever have. You've probably seen commercials that they say, hey, you know, you can't put your enamel back, but you can strengthen it. Nonetheless, that enamel protects the underlying dentin and pulp and this root that runs down into the gum line. What sticks up above that we can see is called the crown. What is below the gum line? The root, right. And of course, this is fed by blood vessels and nerves. Very much makes the tooth alive and have feeling, as we all know. Okay, as promised, there is dental hygiene in 5 minutes. Okay, I did want to mention to you some stuff about the salivary glands. Salivary glands and saliva are directly tied to the health of your teeth. If you have dry mouth, what does that do for the food that's on your teeth?
Sticks.
Sticks, yeah. So, unfortunately, when food sticks to your teeth, it has an opportunity to have bacteria grow and create dental caries, such as cavities. So, dry mouth or other kinds of conditions that can lead to a dry mouth are certainly not good for the health of our teeth. You're looking at a picture here of a sublingual cyst. Let me hit the light. I think you can probably see it better. Yeah, there you go. So if you happen to have a blockage or an inflammation or even a salivary stone, you can end up having a blockage in that cyst, and then there again we see a reduction in the saliva put into the mouth. So salivary stones are kind of like kidney stones. They're calcium-based, and of course if they block that duct of the salivary gland like you see here, then of course they may have to lance open that salivary gland to get the stone to exit. Sometimes they work out on their own, sometimes not. Cancers can also affect those salivary glands. I had a student a few years ago with salivary gland cancer, and she was avoiding having further surgery, but it was a slow-growing, not terribly invasive cancer for her particular situation. But nonetheless, that would be another reason for having dry mouth from, you know, reduced salivary production. I don't know, this convinces me about dental hygiene. I'm like, So there's two issues going on here. Meth mouth, of course, is a reduced dental hygiene, right? No one cares about their teeth if they're hooked on drugs. Okay, and the other issue is that particular drug is high acid. So the acid is poor for the teeth. It helps to degrade the enamel. Let's look at something better than that. Okay. This is the mumps. This is one of the reasons that vaccines are given to kids, known as the MMR vaccine. Mumps is a virus that can attack those salivary glands, cause swelling there. And for boys, it's especially detrimental because it can cause swelling in the testes and sterility there. One of the signs of this thing or this disease is actually a rash, and you can see the horrible swelling around the face there. Very painful disease. All right, so that should take us to the very bottom of your page. Major functions of your mouth include ingestion, which is putting food in your mouth or eating. We talked about that. What accessory organs contribute to mastication? Your teeth, good. So mastication is chewing. And then finally, salivary amylase is a chemical that helps to break down starches into sugars. Yeah, so this is not terribly exciting. What we think of as tasty, tasty food is not really, there's not much happening here. It's just breaking down the food physically, smaller pieces. A little bit of amylase helps to break down those starches into sugars. It's not a whole lot going on in terms of the actual digestion process. So we move the food along to our pharynx when we're done chewing it. You consciously make the decision on the top of page, what is that, 85? Yeah. You moisten a ball of food. You consciously push it to the back of your throat. You consciously decide to swallow that bolus of food. And once the decision is made and you initiate deglutition or swallowing, it is no longer under your control until it comes out the other end. So deglutition is actually a two-part process. It involves a voluntary portion that you control, and it involves an involuntary portion that now takes over through smooth muscle activity. So the voluntary phase is known as the buccal phase. And the involuntary phase is known as the pharyngeal esophageal phase. So I just wanted to show you this little video here. So pretty cool thing, you can actually see the epiglottis and the larynx. Well, I don't know what happened there. There we go. Okay. So we can see the epiglottis, the larynx. You can actually see the swallowing mechanism. There you go. Yeah, and then they actually swallow food in just a moment. It usually doesn't go black screen on me like this, but and then they're going to turn forward here in just a moment. Let's see if we can get it to show that. Maybe not. But I don't know if you can tell, but right through there is the epiglottis. And of course, once it's passed beyond your pharynx at the back of your mouth, that oropharynx region, you no longer have control over it. So at this point, it's all under involuntary control. Okay. So now the food is going to travel down into the esophagus, which has no digestive and no absorptive role. Its only job is to transport food from your pharynx into your stomach. You'll notice that the lining here is stratified squamous epithelium, and that's because we're looking at food traveling through and tearing and wearing down that innermost lining. So, you know, a lot of those more potent cancer drugs, anti-cancer drugs, can cause irritation to the lining of your digestive tract. So if we reduce the amount of mitosis that's happening, we actually reduce the replacement of these layers inside the esophagus. So that's why people who take some of those more potent anti-cancer drugs may have a burning feeling to their esophagus or things like diarrhea, because the lining has inherently changed and is unable to be replaced. Just wanted to mention, no serosa here on the esophagus. Okay, you've got muscularis externa. Underneath that, you've got a submucosa. And deep to that, you've got a mucosa. There is, in fact, no serosa covering the esophagus. Okay, so when we get down to the point where the esophagus joins the stomach, we normally in lab point out that cardiac sphincter as being the point of transition. In reality, we're looking at a tissue transition between the esophagus and the stomach. This is kind of cool because right here you've got, here we go, stratified squamous, and then a line is drawn, and we now have simple columnar epithelium. It is just that abrupt where you have a tissue change from one to the next. So if you wanted to say the definitive point between your esophagus and stomach, you'd actually look for this transition in tissue. So this piece of tissue may in fact be sitting lower down toward your stomach. It may in fact slide up further toward your thorax and your heart. The reason I make the point about the transition is because of this issue. This is a hiatal hernia, and so what has happened here? Acid can float back here. What is this? Is this stomach or esophagus? Are you sure?
It's the stomach, yeah.
So in fact, if you were to look at the lining, you would have simple columnar tissue pushed up above that hiatal opening of the diaphragm there. And there we go with stomach acid gurgling up into that esophagus region. So this is unfortunate because it gives people symptoms that feel like what?
Heartburn,
acid reflux, right. So let's go back and look at the esophagus for just a moment. You can't tell from this picture, but that stomach has a great thick mucus lining. It is great because it helps to prevent that acid from burning through to the underneath layers. The esophagus, however, does not have that thick mucosal lining. There's a stratified squamous set up there, but not the mucus covering. So acid that gurgles back up into your esophagus can form these kinds of ulcers, like you see here, and this is due to acid reflux, known as GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease. Ouch.
Yes.
Yeah. Looking like we're ready for the stomach near the bottom of your page. Okay, so tell me about stomach anatomy. What are the four regions? Good, okay. And the one closest to the duodenum is? Good, okay. And the lining is known as? Brugge, yeah. And it's present when you are full or empty?
Empty.
Empty, yeah. So there you go. You've got some Brugge there. Okay. There are two sphincters here. There is one at the junction between esophagus and stomach. It's called? Cardiac sphincter, and its alternate name is lower esophageal sphincter. There's another sphincter down here at this end, this pyloric sphincter. And so thinking about the layers that make up your GI tract, you've got mucosa, submucosa, muscularis externa, and serosa. Which one do you think makes these rings of muscles for the sphincters?
Circular,
yeah. Muscularis externa, circular muscles make these rings called sphincters. They are pressure regulated, so when food pushes against them, they open. When there's no food there, they stay closed. They work both ways. Food sitting on top will make them open. Food sitting on the bottom will make them open. So that's how, if you're having a really full meal, you can eventually push a piece of your stomach up above your diaphragm, promoting a hiatal hernia. Okay, so looks like we're ready for the microscopic anatomy of your stomach. Your stomach actually has these pits known as gastric pits. And in these gastric pits are a number of different cells that contribute to the process of breaking foods down. So let's start off with the enteroendocrine cell. Before you read any further, what does endocrine tell you? Hormone, yeah, something about a hormone. So in fact, there's about 7 different hormones made by the stomach. We're not going to do all of them, thank goodness, right? Okay, we're just going to hit a few. And the one we're going to discuss right now is called gastrin. Okay, so the name gastrin sounds like stomach, and that's for a good reason. Because when you talk about food, smell food, taste food, and eat food, which autonomic branch is in control? Parasympathetic, right. What wandering cranial nerve innervates your stomach? Vagus, good. Vagus nerve says, hey, you're in parasympathetic mode. Let's turn on gastrin. So like all hormones, how does gastrin travel? Bloodstream, good, good. So listen to how crazy this is. When you're talking about food, your vagus nerve turns on gastrin. Gastrin is produced by an enteroendocrine cell, and the target is the stomach, a neighboring cell. So the target, in fact, are these parietal cells sitting right here. So it'd be like if you want to go over and tell your next-door neighbor something, getting in the car, driving around the block, coming in another street, coming back down, pulling in their driveway, and then ringing the doorbell. So that's what gastrin does. It takes the long route around through the bloodstream, but eventually targets a neighboring cell called the parietal cells. So unfortunately, that's just the way hormones work, right? They take the long route through the bloodstream. Once we get gastrin in the bloodstream, hydrochloric acid, here we are, an intrinsic factor, are released by your parietal cells. Okay, so what does this do to your pH in your stomach when you get hydrochloric acid present? Decreases it, right. How low can you go? How low is stomach pH going to be? Yeah, like 1 or 2. And when we talk about the pH scale, that's as strong as battery acid. Okay, that is so strong it can erode away your tooth enamel. If you have esophageal reflux disease and you're burping up acid into your mouth, it can cause ulcers in your esophagus. It can cause erosion of your tooth enamel. So for those who have a reflux disease or another disease that makes them vomit frequently, that is a problem for causing ulcerations and erosion. So hydrochloric acid is really important because it helps us make the stomach ready for all the food that's coming down there. Let's talk about the second thing that's produced there called intrinsic factor. Intrinsic factor is important because it helps us absorb a particular vitamin. Which one?
B12,
good. All right, this is going to go back in your brain. What do you need B12 to make? Red blood cells. Yeah, good. Red blood cells. And if you don't have enough intrinsic factor, you have a type of anemia known as pernicious. Yeah, pernicious anemia. Okay, so do you need the spelling for pernicious anemia? Yeah, P-E-R-N. Yeah, you're right, I-C. You got it, I-O-U-S. So let's hit the story from the top. If you see food, smell food, taste food, or eat food, you turn on your parasympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system. That branch has the vagus nerve that innervates your stomach. When you're in this mode, your vagus nerve releases gastrin from your enteroendocrine cells. Gastrin, like any hormone, travels the bloodstream, and it targets a neighboring cell known as a parietal cell. Those parietal cells release hydrochloric acid and intrinsic factor. Which of those two chemicals acidifies your stomach pH?
HCl.
Good. What is hydrochloric acid needed for?
B12.
Good. So you need it to make blood cells. So we're going to use those two as a starting off point. I'm going to now tackle that hydrochloric acid because it's really important for what you see next. Next, you notice on your worksheet, the chief cells release pepsinogen. Okay, so pepsinogen has a gen suffix. What does that tell you?
Make.
Good. Pepsinogen says, I make pepsin. But the catch is, you've got to have the right pH to make pepsinogen activate into pepsin. And the pH is, guess what? Acid, yeah, very low acid. So if you have an acidic environment in your stomach, pepsinogen will then be activated into pepsin. What does pepsin help us hydrolyze?
Proteins,
good. So I want to make sure you heard me use the word hydrolyze. Hydrolyze is hydrolysis or catabolism. That is taking proteins, which are big molecules, and breaking them into what? Monomers. Yeah, and the monomer of an amino... Oh, I gave it to you. Yeah. That's great, right? Okay, so the monomer for a protein is an amino acid. That's the goal of pepsin. Yeah, break it up. Okay, so let me kind of take a step back and think big picture here. A lot of drugs are on the market for heartburn, acid reflux. They are called hydrogen ion or proton pump inhibitors. You've probably heard them marketed as Nexium, what else? Prilosec, Zantac. Gosh, there's tons of that stuff out there, right? Tagamint, all that stuff. So if you take one of those drugs that blocks hydrochloric acid release from your parietal cells, what impact will that have on your stomach acid? Increases it, yeah. If you block hydrogen ions from being released with your hydrochloric acid, then your stomach acid won't be as acidic. It'll actually be a little more alkaline in nature. So instead of being maybe 1 or 2 on the pH scale, you may be looking at something like 4 or 5 on the pH scale. Well, that may seem like it's not a big deal. You know, it helps you from having acid reflux and heartburn. The next step, though, is to look at those proteins. What happens to pepsinogen in a more alkaline pH? It doesn't turn into pepsin, and you don't break down proteins. Yes, yeah, so, you know, they say that every drug has a pro and a con. This would, of course, be the drawback of having something like a proton pump inhibitor. There is going to be an effect toward digestion. Okay, so we've got mucus neck cells. They release a thick layer of mucus onto your stomach's lining. What benefit do you get from that? Yeah, protects your stomach. Your stomach doesn't eat itself, right? Okay, so yeah, that mucus neck cell is going to release a thick layer of mucus that does protect your mucus or your stomach lining. Let's see, we've also got renin down there. Notice it's got two N's, R-E-N-N-I-N, as opposed to the renin-angiotensin mechanism, which is spelled with one N. And I want to make that point because these are two totally different renins. This one breaks down what? Milk proteins, right. So you've got a tag team here. You've got pepsin and you've got renin that break down proteins in your stomach. Sometimes moms, you know, of little babies have the baby spit up something that looks like cottage cheese or curdled milk, and they think, oh gosh, you know, this baby's sick. And in fact, that is exactly what renin is supposed to do. It is supposed to break down milk proteins into something that looks like cottage cheese. So not that as adults we have the habit of vomiting after we drink milk, but if we were, we'd probably see the very same thing, something that looks like a cottage cheese mixture. Gross. Let's see, another one there is called ghrelin, and it, like the name implies, it is a hormone that stimulates appetite. I kind of think of it sounding like growlin, and I'm sure that was not a mistake. So, okay, near the bottom of your page, and I'll come back to that physiology and those blanks in just a moment, Let me make sure you've got the blanks at the very, very bottom where it says, let's review. You got the vagus nerve. Okay, it turns on a hormone called, you got it, gastrin. Gastrin, like any hormone, travels the bloodstream, and it comes back and targets parietal cells. Those parietal cells release two chemicals. Good. Yep. And on the left is your hydrochloric acid, and on the right, that blank is intrinsic factor. Okay, let's take hydrochloric acid first. We know it acidifies your stomach's pH. It is also important for helping us convert blank into blank. Good, yeah, pepsinogen into pepsin. Pepsinogen into pepsin. And on the right, we know that the intrinsic factor is important for B12 absorption. We know B12 is needed for red blood cell production. Okay. So let me hit you right before that with the physiology of the stomach in terms of summary of activities. The stomach does have an additional oblique layer of muscularis externa, which is great for grinding food into smaller particles. But the only actual digestion that occurs here in terms of the term hydrolysis is only proteins. So we only hydrolyze the proteins here in the stomach. There's actually very little absorption here. We're limited to two items. What are they? What do people do at a bar at night?
Drink.
On an empty stomach, right? There you go. Okay, so on an empty stomach, alcohol goes straight into your bloodstream through your stomach lining, one of the few things. So one of those blanks is alcohol.
And aspirin.
And aspirin, good. Alcohol and aspirin. Deadly duo, right? So why don't we take a look at page 87? That's probably going to be about as far as we get today. So tell me what your favorite foods are.
Mexican food.
What else?
Sweet things.
Sweet things. I'm with you there. Chocolate. Pizza. Steak, macaroni, chicken. We should open a restaurant, you know.
Anything home cooked.
Yeah. You've probably pretty much hit the same thing that most of my classes in previous terms talk about. Somebody always says a good steak dinner. Somebody always says spaghetti or lasagna, some type of pasta, pizza, fried chicken, mashed potatoes. Hot chocolate cake right out of the oven with icing and ice cream on top. I think we're done with class. We're just going to have to go eat now, right? So what I'm doing to you is purposeful. I want you to think about what you like to eat because that's going to turn on one of your three phases of your stomach's activities. What we're doing by talking about food is the cephalic phase of stomach activities. What does cephalic mean? Your head. I'm messing with your head, right, by talking about food. And if you're hungry, boy, your stomach's going to be growling in about 20 minutes, right? So when you talk about food, see food, smell food, taste food, all that has to do with your head, and that actually activates your vagus nerve, and your vagus nerve goes to your stomach and tells your enteroendocrine cells to turn on and release gastrin. Well, you've got the ball rolling now. What happens to your stomach pH after gastrin is present? Makes it very acidic, yeah, decreases that stomach pH. So now we've just turned on our stomach activities. I have taught this topic in the morning, like at 9:30 in the morning, many years, and I swear to you, by 10 o'clock, I am starving, you know, because you've got the whole mechanism turned on. So this can happen whether or not you eat food, simply talking about it, walking into a restaurant or into your home where there's food cooking can simply turn on this mechanism, and then you realize you're about to starve for something to eat. Once you actually are eating, we now move into what's called the gastric phase of your stomach's activities. Food is going into your stomach is filling with food, the walls are stretching, and this further increases the release of gastrin, hydrochloric acid, intrinsic factor. We're breaking down proteins. And then you're done eating. So when you finish eating, you are probably full at this point, or you're adequately satisfied with what you've eaten. And at this point, you'll notice that we're going to slow the stomach's activities. The vagus nerve is no longer telling the enteroendocrine cells to release gastrin. In fact, what we have is a set of hormones that push back and tell the stomach to slow itself down. There is a hormone called gastrin-inhibiting peptide, GIP for short. What impact does this one have on gastrin? Lowers it, stops it, decreases it. Good. Cholecystokinin, you'll notice that fancy word, it's CCK for short, is made by your small intestine. It too says to your stomach, hey, slow down. So what if your stomach continued grinding and churning food like crazy and was pushing that food like mad into your very small intestine? Would your small intestine be able to adequately absorb nutrients? Mm-hmm. No. So how long does it take for your stomach to empty?
4 hours.
Yeah, about 4 to 6 hours, yeah. And that is universal. Well, maybe from not everybody, right? So normally upon finishing a meal, it's somewhere between 4 and 6 hours that you're ready for your next one. It takes that long for your stomach to squirt about a teaspoon's worth of food through the pyloric sphincter and into this duodenum. You know, if you opened up the floodgates and you said, hey, small intestine, here comes a gallon's worth of halfway digested food, your small intestine says, oh, to heck with this. And it lets it flush onto the large intestine, and now you've got diarrhea. Yeah. So, in fact, that is called dumping syndrome. No joke. But that's what happens. If your pyloric sphincter just opens up and lets it go, you can't process and absorb those nutrients. It is actually, that actually comes from people that have gastric bypass surgery. And if they eat too much, the pyloric sphincter just goes blue and just lets it go. Something similar, yeah. IBS, I believe, is more like an inflammation to the lining than simply the dumping syndrome. Yeah.
You get too much of your intestine.
Like a fiber, yeah, yeah. So I just want to mention that the first two phases, the head phase, the stomach phase, encourage your stomach to do its job, release those hormones, release the chemicals, promote the digestion. But this phase here, this intestinal phase, is meant to work against your stomach. It is a reflex called the enterogastric reflex, and we're actually telling the stomach, hey, slow down, stop moving so much, stop producing so many chemicals, the show is over, they're done eating. So this is working against what the stomach is you know, designed to do, which is grind up and digest that food. All right, so I actually gave you a blank a little bit ahead of time. Down there under gastric motility and emptying, 4 to 6 hours is your normal time for emptying. And some things that can slow the emptying of your stomach include things like a large meal, What else might make your stomach empty more slowly than normal? Fatty foods and a protein-rich diet. Yep. So eat just some protein-enriched meals. You can survive off of less calories and stay full longer because proteins are big. They're hard to break down. Just a little bit at the last of your page there. Gastritis is a catch-all term that means inflammation of the stomach. If you've had a virus where you've been vomiting and having, you know, upset stomach, they may not know the underlying cause and they'll simply say you've had gastritis. When we've had stomach irritation, we want to avoid milk products. Milk products actually induce mucus production. That does not sound good if you've had an upset stomach. So recommended is a BRAT diet based on bananas, rice, applesauce, and toast. None of that stuff has dairy in it, so in hopes to reduce the amount of mucus that's being produced by the stomach. So the last thing you want to do after having vomited is go grab yourself a milkshake, right? I just wanted to mention gastric bypass surgery and all the problems that comes with. Nowadays, they're not really favoring this, it seems, as much as they are things like a lap band surgery. What is the problem with removing a big piece of your stomach from the whole digestive process? Yeah, less protein digestion, less B12 absorption. Wow, that's a lot that's going on there, right? So we can end up with things like anemia and malnutrition. They don't take out this piece of the stomach and small intestine. It is left in your body to growl because it still thinks it's attached and it still thinks it might get food. So it's still going to growl and look for food to come to it. So how crazy is that, that that piece that's left behind may actually think it's going to be fed? Poor stomach. It's sad. It eventually learns, but, you know. Ulcers are nowadays thought to be believed to be caused by a bacterium called Helicobacter. And, you know, back in the day they used to say, oh, it's stress, you know, you got a stressful job, which may make ulcers worse, peptic ulcers. But nonetheless, we now know that ulcers are often caused by this Helicobacter infection. I just want to tell you how common this is. 70% of us carry it around and don't have a problem with it. It is so common that you can go out here to the water fountain and pick it up. So that's kind of a scary thought, right? No more drinking out of the water fountain. No. Yes, sir.
So wait a minute. My brother had like bleeding in his intestines, and they said that it was an ulcer. So is that what
I mean, if it was in his intestines, they might have sourced it back to a peptic ulcer. Yeah. So yeah, oftentimes it will produce a dark stool.
Yeah.
They may not pinpoint exactly where that ulcer is unless they do like an endoscope and look in there.
Yeah, they had to do that. Surgery.
Gotcha. Yeah. Pretty nasty situation there because you've got all that blood and acid that can mix. Yeah.
Yeah, he was also like coughing up blood.
Ooh, goodness.
Yeah.
Quite a bad situation there. Yeah. Well, that's good. Hey, that's it for this page. You guys have a great week, and I will see you back on next Monday, July the 10th. Yeah.